All right, on today's podcast, we have John Cochran. He is the Rosemarie and Jack Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And before that, John was a Distinguished Senior Fellow at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's taught both MBA and PhD programs. He was also a fellow of the Becker Friedman Institute, a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's a past president and fellow of the American Finance Institution and a fellow of the Econometric Society. He served as editor of numerous economic journals. He's earned a bachelor's degree of physics at MIT and a PhD in economics at Cal Berkeley. And perhaps more importantly, one of the co-hosts of one of my favorite podcasts, the Goodfellows podcast. How are you, John?
I'm great. And don't forget to plug the Grumpy Economist blog. But
and the Grumpy Economist blog. That's right.
Thank you.
That's right. I am a reader of that as well. So I've done a lot of prep on you here and listened to a lot of your interviews. And I'm not sure that there is a cohesive John Cochran story out there of how you became the prolific economist that you are. And especially, you know, getting that bachelor's degree in physics. Why don't we start there? How did you become an economist?
Well, I had some sort of conversion moments to economics. One was just sitting in my first economics class where this was in the late 1970s and sort of welfare and welfare dependency was in the air. And they showed us the budget constraint, the opportunities facing someone on welfare, which at the time went, if you earn under $15,000, you get a free apartment and food and medical care. And if you earn $15,001, we take it all away from you. And it just hit me there, but for the grace of good luck go I. We are all the same. I would do the same thing in the same situation. And that opened my eyes to at the time, there was lots of political and, you know, culture and all the same kind of politics and moralizing that goes on today, but to see a value-free cause and effect analysis of a prominent, important social problem that tells you where the problem is, how to fix it, and says all people are alike. They're not dumb. They're actually, you have to be quite smart to navigate the social welfare system. That was really an eye opener. And also I saw that the tools of physics could be used creatively to address important problems like that. So I went on off to economics and it's been a wonderful tour ever since.
What do you mean tools of physics?
Oh, well, the kind of math and modeling skills that we use in economics are essentially those of the first two or three years of physics. And it's not just the math. Mathematicians don't do that well in economics. It's the ability to take a situation, distill it down to its essence, and produce a little model economy that you understand how it all works. That expresses itself in some very simple math, but it's the modeling skill. And physics teaches you that modeling skill very well. We jokingly call physics the science of massless elephants on frictionless planes. That's what physics is about. And that's what economics is about. People criticize, oh, you left out that people are complicated and all sorts of problems. Yeah, exactly. You leave out the unimportant stuff to distill down to the quantitative parable that really explains what's going on. So that physics skill of making good models is what economics is all about.
How has the field of economics changed since you got into it?
Oh my gosh. How long you got? all sorts of, it's been, economics is really going through all sorts of interesting transitions. I came of age during the death of Keynesian economics, although like a zombie, it keeps coming back and can't seem to kill it. But the intellectual death of Keynesian economics, which was fascinating and learning how the central problem with Keynesian economics, it treats every moment in time as its own universe. Whereas what we learned while I was young was how people think about today versus tomorrow. And that's the key element of understanding macroeconomics. Growth theory came while I was young in the 1990s. Economics hadn't thought about really where does the most important thing in everything is, you know, look at you and me and compare us to our great, 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 our ancestors of the 1800s. I don't know who mine were, but they were probably hoeing potatoes in some field in Germany. And look how much better off we are. That's the most important thing there is in economics. And where does it come from? It had kind of been a trend line until about 1990. And then we started thinking about, economists started thinking about where does it come from and what can we do to make, and when will it end? Which is, I think, the approximate. I haven't worked on that because you work on things where you think you can make a contribution, not necessarily things that are really important. And I recognize growth is the most important thing, but that's not where I think I can help advance things. So I kind of follow it and cheer it, but that's another example. And of course, there's been the micro data revolution more recently, where economists have, empirical economics has gotten much, much, much better. Now, in some ways it's overdone it, and we can fight about that. But when I was young, there was sort of loosey-goosey regressions of right shoe sales on left shoe sales and bad data. And now sort of the big data and causal inference revolution has really taken over microeconomics, sometimes to a fault, but at least it's a whole lot different. And I could go on. It's a really exciting, fast-moving field. It's been a pleasure to be part of it.
Now, in terms of fast moving, you're talking about the death of Keynesian economics. Well, it seems like everyone's a Keynesian now. Is that true? Have we come full circle?
In some sense, everyone's a Keynesian now, but in some sense, nobody's a Keynesian now. So Keynesian economics still gets used in sort of the back of the envelope. Well, the government spends a dollar, GDP goes up a dollar and a half sort of thing. But let's compare it to the very sophisticated Keynesian economics of my youth. The 1970s, when there were huge models that sort of looked like climate models that tried to quantitatively assess policies. And people would seriously say, okay, here's the government's budget plan, and here is our Keynesian forecast of what it's going to do to the economy. And these would appear in academic journals and be taken seriously. No one does that anymore. There's this kind of back of the envelope fairy story that remains told in policy circles. And it certainly pervades that fairy story pervades our central banks, but it's back to a back of the envelope, sort of the stories you tell your children to scare them into behaving, as opposed to a scientific quantitative mechanism, which is what it was in the 1970s until it was found to be, empty. So it's funny that in some sense, yes, it remains the center because it's an easy story to tell. Government spends more money, things get better. Until you actually look at the fact that it doesn't add up at all. And if you were to try to write down some equations and model, you'd have to face the fact that it doesn't add up at all and make any sense. So it's funny that the more what I call intertemporal economics hasn't been able to take over yet in policy discussions. It's certainly Keynesian economics remains dead as a scientific enterprise. Now, there is this new Keynesian stuff, which is a different thing, which we'll talk about, maybe not. I'm referring to the sort of standard ISLM. It's also true that the people in charge of policy now are my age and a little bit older. So we're all brought up. Their undergraduate classes were moving IS and LM curves around. And it's interesting how much that sticks.
Could you explain that real quick?
No. If you don't know what, there's these ancient fallacies in old religion that I'm not going to try to explain in two sentences, but there's this mechanism of 1970s textbooks in how you think about government spending and monetary policy and so forth. And it's really interesting if you listen to our policymakers who were all educated in the 1970s, they revert to that as their standard. But, the new generation either was not taught that or wasn't taught it seriously. So it'll be interesting to see what happens 10 years from now.
Now, kind of on the other side of the coin, or perhaps, you know, just orthogonally related here, this is the Narrative Monopoly podcast where we have nuanced discussions outside of the narrative monopoly. But, you know, it's not just the media talking about inflation. There are a lot of smart people ringing the alarm bells, a lot of people who are quite frankly just making fun of the term transitory. And so I think that you're probably the best guy to ask here, what's going on with inflation?
Well, I'm one of those people who's, you know, ringing the alarm bells. Now I'm cautious because I've been ringing the alarm bells for 20 years and I've been wrong for 20 years. And at least I'm honest enough to recognize that fact. I do. So I think the way I put it now is I think there is a risk of inflation, but not the certainty of inflation. And inflation is inherently, sort of like stock prices, it is inherently unpredictable. So one of the things I like to say, I know as an economist, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know why everybody else who sounds like they know is wrong in great detail. So knowing why things aren't true is just as important as knowing what is true. So inflation is unpredictable, in large part because the way to think about inflation is there's something that moves inflation, too much demand or money or fiscal stimulus or whatever you want to call it. But then that thing moves today's inflation relative to where people expect inflation in the future. So these expectations really matter. And as long as people, if you're a business and you think there's going to be inflation next year, you raise your prices now. On top of, you know, you think about two things. You think about, are there lots of people showing up who want to buy stuff? Should raise my prices. And, is this going to stick? Is there going to be higher prices next year? So that you need that force of people showing up to try to buy stuff, but it's going to happen more quickly and more permanently if you start to think, oh, and next year is going to be worse and everyone else is going to be raising their prices next year, so I don't have to worry so much. So that's why there's kind of a tipping point aspect to it. As long as people think, oh, it's only transitory, then it probably is going to be only transitory. Now, we've redone this. I can tell you're too young to remember the 1970s, but and it's actually, this has been a real insight for me. When I went to grad school, I remember all these old guys talking about the 1930s and the Great Depression. Like, oh yeah, okay, guys, but you know, it was terrible. And I read Grapes of Wrath and I saw the WPA posters and Dorothea Lange photographs, but you know, why are you so obsessed by this? You probably feel the same way because you weren't around in the 1970s and old guys like me are obsessed by it.
It feels distant, but it's scary.
It is. There are signs of repeating some of the same mistakes. When I hear what the Federal Reserve says, their official, how do we think about monetary policy? It sounds a whole lot like what the Federal Reserve say in the early 1970s. What happened as prices started to go up in the early 1970s? Oh, it's transitory. Oh, it's supply bottlenecks. Oh, it's temporary factors that are going to go away. Well, I'm hearing the same thing now. How did they talk about their policy? They said in the 1970s, well, inflation, but it's only transitory, and we really have a big unemployment problem. And when we have to let the inflation, you know, kind of go a bit to kind of help the. They didn't use the words marginalized and under and so forth. They used different words, but here we are again. So the ingredients are kind of there, and the ingredients are even worse. What anchors inflation expectations? Well, people think that should inflation get bad, the Fed will raise interest rates and do something about it, right? That's why don't you think there's going to be inflation next year? Because you think if it does happen, the Fed will do something about it. So you think it's not going to happen. And so that's where the expectations come from. Do you really think our Federal Reserve will do what it did in 1980? Interest rates of 20%, unemployment rates over 10%, hitting all of those marginalized groups that the Fed is now worried about inequality. Do they have the guts to do that? Or will they do what they did in 1973, 1975, and 1978, which is, we don't have the stomach for this. Yeah, you know, we'll talk about price controls and so forth. It's hard to believe, and it's going to be harder this time, because this time we got that big federal debt. If the Fed raises interest rates, it doesn't just cause unemployment among people who are going to be really hurt by unemployment. the Fed interest rate raises interest rates now, it's going to explode the deficit and Congress is going to be mad as hell. If the Fed interest rates raises interest rates now, it's going to be printing money to give high interest rates to big banks so that those big banks don't lend that money to needy Americans. Imagine Congress exploding at that one. And third, if the Fed raises interest rates now, all of those big banks are going to be in deep trouble because they've lent money long-term at low interest rates and they have to borrow, they're rolling over short-term interest rates to fund it. So the Fed is much more politicized now than even it was in the 1970s. So, this is why I worry, among many other things, we seem to be in the same situation as the early 1970s, and with a harder task ahead of us if inflation breaks out. If we get lucky, it doesn't, won't happen. Anyway, that's enough on inflation for a while.
You know, one point you hit there was around the culture of the American public. I mean, I think that, you know, we're certainly less primed to endure hardship now than certainly in the majority of the American past. But now, you know, everyone's got their SUVs, their cell phones, their TVs, their air conditioning. Not that I would want to give any of that stuff up either, but, you know, just as a society, you know, the world has been so relatively easy for the last 20 years, outside of basically the financial crisis and the war on terror. But those things seem like blips on the radar compared to, what the world has had to go through in the past. Let me clarify
Let's just stop on that note. You know, remember what our ancestors went through. The Great Depression, World War II was pretty darn bad compared to what we've been through. And overall, there's a lot of hand-wringing and life is terrible and terrible, but life in contemporary America is just slowly getting better and better. If you look at life expectancy, disease rates, decline in poverty, especially globally, decline in overall level of violence, despite the recent upticks, we forget what the best year in all of recorded human history was, you know, this one or last, I forget which of the last three it is, but it's right there. I did want to also mention on inflation, just to go back a little bit. It's not where history never repeats itself. And that's why people get caught flat footed. You can't just fight the last war a little bit better. And I do think that the debt issue, which I know you want to get to, but I'll tee that up for later. That threatens inflation in a way that we didn't face in the 1970s. We had a 25% debt to GDP ratio. So whatever was going on, it wasn't a debt crisis. Now it's 100 and exploding and no way of paying it back. And that puts us into a kind of a debt crisis mechanics for inflation that the Fed won't be able to do anything about. And of course, there's the second big danger, not repeating mistakes of the 1970s, which after all of the Fed was steeped in the 1970s. There's no question they know the history of the 1970s and what it took, and at least know the battle plan for, you know, we got the Maginot Line already, guys, because we know that battle plan. But the danger is a fiscal danger that they are intellectually completely on, and it's not just the Fed, the Treasury has to step in and put the fiscal house in order. Sorry, I didn't want to leave inflation without mentioning fiscal problems because that's my big project at the moment, which I have to.
No, I know the episode with Brian Riedel before, I got a lot of feedback that it was incredibly informative about, you know, the debt, but that people were very sad after it. So we do need to put some lipstick on this, it or at least try.
Okay.
Brian, we dig into it. Yeah, no. And I would say also that with the struggle, obviously COVID, I left that one out of the last 20 years. Oh, yes. But
COVID, yeah. let's talk just briefly about COVID. COVID has revealed the shocking incompetence of our bureaucracy to this day. I can't believe we're on the 10-yard line and we're dropping the ball here because we had vaccines. We had an amazing scientific technical answer to this thing. No one since the plague of Justinian. So nobody has had this. And yet we can't get around to just minor incentives to go out, you morons, and get vaccinated and we'll end this thing. the last of the bureaucratic bungling of this crisis. I mean, we still don't have a year and a half into this thing. We don't have data, just random data. How many people have this where? We're still counting, you know, confirmed case counts, which is a ridiculous number. Don't get me started on the bungling. But my point, this was the fire drill, guys. This we think of this as a terrible, awful global pandemic. In terms of deaths, it's not as nearly as bad as the flu of 1918. You know, on the level of the flu of 1957, which we did not close down the economy for. This was the fire drill. Yeah, you know, a fraction of 1% die. Mostly old people. I feel sorry for old people who die, but it's not as far as, you know, keeping a society and an economy going. Imagine 1918, where it's all the young working people who are dying. Imagine 1350, where half to three quarters of the population dies. This is a nothing burger in terms of pandemic, and look how completely bungled we have. This is the fire drill, and we failed it. And more pandemics are coming unless mRNA vaccines turn out to be the godsend that they are, and they will be much worse.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's exactly it in terms of, you know, 1918. It's people don't realize, you know, wrapping that into everything. People don't realize the water they swim in, right? So we talk about all these problems in society, but in reality, what that generation would have given for the mRNA vaccines right away, and all of the medical care that we did have for folks who went to the hospital. And I'm sure that future generations will look back at our at this pandemic and just say, wow, I can't believe that, you know, that there are pandemics, right? I mean, hopefully that's the case.
Well, that'll be the interesting, you know, we're in a race of evolution and exponential growth against bureaucratic bungling. And so there is the hopeful thing is that the mRNA vaccine, I don't know if your listeners know, was invented in a weekend. It took one weekend to find the scientific answer to this disease. Then it took 9 months for the FDA to let anybody have it, 2 months for the CDC to let tests out of the front door that could do it. They still haven't given it a full use authorization, which is giving lots of people excuses to not take it. But you know, the scientific possibility that we could actually end a large fraction of viral infections would be fantastic. You know, freeing humanity from pandemics would be wonderful. Or, you know, evolution could win. and this is the first one before we see what the Black Plague looked like.
Now, you were talking about the efficacy of government, pretty much, and the failure of the bureaucracy. You know, we don't have to go into the specifics about the CDC, but I like one of your lines that you use a lot on Goodfellas is the wokes versus the Woodstocks. And I just did my first short episode on this app call-in of the Narrative Monopoly. And I was talking about how the US really has no counterculture anymore in the arts and what that actually means. And my point was that not only could the federal government not get us into another Vietnam, not that we would want them to, but let's even say Korea, right? So Korea is this war where it's basically us just saying, hey, you know, we need to back up our word and, you know, we're going to go kick some ass and take some names in order to do so. You know, it was certainly not like a World War II. And so I don't think that the US government would have the ability to do that politically or operationally. But then what's more troubling to me and kind of this meta point is that I don't think that there could be another Woodstock. And I don't think that there could be another, you know, CCR, Jimi Hendrix, or the Doors, in that type of energy that is, you know, as you talk, the wokes versus the Woodstock, the traditional American liberalism, that is the other side of that coin. I think that everyone is kind of a conformist now. And I think that puts or releases any pressure on actually having a government that has the ability to execute on damaging things because people just don't question authority. That's kind of a random thought that I have here, but I do love your line. So if you want to extrapolate on the wokes versus the Woodstock, and if that does play into government efficacy, I would love to know your thoughts.
Oh, wow. You served up a smorgasbord of fun stuff there. What can I say? Well, we may get our Korea in the form of Taiwan. You know, what happens when China invades Taiwan will be a interesting question for U.S. military foreign policy and our nation as a whole. Now, it won't reproduce either Korea or Vietnam. I don't think there's any, you know, but one of the problems of Vietnam is our lack of faith in the South Vietnamese government. Well placed. What was the alternative going to be? But certainly that will be a test for America when it comes, like Korea. What you point out is interesting. Of course, the Woodstock generation was the counterculture, and wokeism is now the culture. It has taken over all universities, 100%. Go look at the Stanford Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion website, and you'll see Ibrahim X. Kendi is now not even, science is debatable. This is no longer debatable. These are facts to be simply taught by administrators. And then it's not just universities. All large businesses, all philanthropic nonprofit organizations, every branch of government, now including the Federal Reserve, is part. So you can't be the counterculture anymore. And it's probably like, yeah, by 1978, you know, TV anchors had long hair down to here and big sideburns, and so the counterculture took over. You know, the music, as Tom Lehrer said, they had all the good songs. Music was certainly a lot better on that side. So, and arts, you mentioned, the arts have been 100% extreme left wing for about 50 years. And I know some struggling realistic libertarian artists, and boy, is that a tough business to try to be in. The woke versus Woodstock joke was more about what I notice within the sort of shocked corridors of the New York Times and the New Yorker and the Atlantic and so forth. A generation of good-thinking liberals from the 1970s and 1980s, who nonetheless still believe in free speech, who nonetheless believe in tolerance, who believe that it's okay to have friends who are conservatives and to discuss things with them and treat them as people rather than as enemies to be shunned or sent off to re-education camps, versus the young millennial wokes who show up and have their trigger problems and whatever. So that there's a real and that's going on in universities. You know, we have a sort of a free speech group at Stanford, which includes lots of good 1970s and 1980s liberals who are shocked at the Maoism of the young. So that's a genuine that's a genuine tension that I think will be interesting to see play out.
Do you think that is impacting the government's ability to be effective? Or you think that's just a totally different question?
Government and effective are words that, you know.
Relatively. Okay.
Relatively.
Like Eisenhower, building the Golden Gate Bridge, that the first half of the 20th century versus now.
Well, yeah, building the Golden Gate Bridge and building the interstate highway system,
Marshall Plan, and all that stuff. Well,
so that we don't even have to get into wokeism to figure out why that's impossible. Oh, I guess there are some elements to it. You know, we just canceled Keystone Pipeline, but approved the North Stream 2 pipeline for reasons that don't make much sense to me. But that's the good old fashioned sand in the gears of the American political system, I think, got to the impossibility of infrastructure before even woke themes brought it along. You can stop anything you want with environmental suits, and it has nothing to do with the environment. It just says, you know, if you don't want a freeway going through your backyard, it's easy enough to stop it. The costs have completely exploded, part because, you know, it takes bike lanes have now been stopped throughout California because of environmental reviews, as an example, to say nothing of our high speed train, which is going absolutely nowhere. That the New York subway that cost, $4 billion a mile we're paying orders of magnitude more than libertarian France pays to put stuff in. And you just can't get the right of way. That's regular interest group sand in the gears of a legal and regulatory system run amok before we get to the wokeism. The wokeism part is America is on, I called it the Great Awokening. I view the phenomenon as something that's happened before, a guilty self-flagellation of rich white descendants of Protestants who want to feel guilty and retreat to their homes in Palo Alto and read critical race theory so that they can feel better about Black people who they never actually meet in real life. I'm being harsh, but I think you can only analyze the moment as a religious sort of awakening. Now, along a religious religion, in many cases, justifies horrendous treatment of the outgroup. So the mechanics of the Russian Revolution and the Cultural Revolution are here as well. Silencing of speech, demonizing opposition, taking over a small minority can use this ideology and all its made up language to take power. And they have done so remarkably well. They have taken the levers of all of the institutions of civil society. That's a remarkable feat, and we'll see where it goes. And it's profoundly undemocratic, little d. It's profoundly capital D democratic. But the same people who are going on about threats to our democracy, the last thing they want is for the large majority of Americans who don't believe in this stuff to vote them out of power. And as the Bolsheviks didn't win any elections. They had a small minority and they took control. So the mechanism is a small minority self-justified by this religion that wants to take control. I think you pose this as a question of the efficacy of technocratic government. And I don't think that's the way to think about it at all, in part because technocratic government is so unbelievably incompetent. I think we learned that in the financial crisis. And if we didn't learn that again in COVID, well, something will come along 10 years from now to remind us about the complete incompetence of our elites. Perhaps the way central banks want to dive into climate policy will convince people of the complete incompetence of our elites.
So that's a great segue, because you've done a lot of work here recently, specifically on your blog, The Grumpy Economist. How would you synthesize that of what's going on with central banks who are ostensibly, chartered to deal with monetary issues and the economy writ large, now diving into climate policy? And there's actually, one post we can get to it that you had, which was, how much does climate change actually affect GDP? That's the one I wanted to dive into. But I think a good bridge to walk over is how central banks are now starting to say that they're going to factor in climate policy.
Let's just, I'm a complete believer in climate change. I will accept anything that the normal crowd talks about is the science of climate change. The planet is getting warmer, guys. And sure, carbon dioxide is why it's getting warmer. So let's just follow some line. We could talk larger issues about climate change and climate policy and what's wise and what's not wise to do about climate policy. The particular thing that annoyed me here was central banks getting involved in climate policy. Now, central banks, we have to remember, we are still somewhat a constitutional government that follows rule of law. And independent agents that deal with an independent agency like the Federal Reserve in a democracy is you get to be independent and you have enormous power, but you have to follow certain limited scope of action. The central bank worries about inflation and employment. Those are its mandates. It worries about financial stability. But if the central bank decides that climate is a problem, the central bank may not go in and execute climate policy, no matter how useful climate policy is. That's the job for the EPA, for the Treasury, for Congress, for politically. Climate policy is extremely costly. It's politically contentious. You may not stay an independent agency if you do that. So the issue isn't about the advisability of climate policy or specific climate policies. The issue that I got upset about is central banks diving into this. So how do central banks allow themselves legally, morally, constitutionally, to start telling banks, don't lend to oil companies because that's bad for the climate? The central bank has no authority over the climate. Well, to do that, they have to invent the idea that there's climate risk. They're allowed to worry about risks to the financial system. So what they say is, well, climate poses a risk to the financial system. And therefore, since we're allowed to worry about risks to the financial system, we're allowed to impose climate policies. Well, that's just complete nonsense. So as far as, look, the science is the Earth is warming. And the science, whether weather's getting more extreme, frankly, we're not quite so sure about that. But there is no science that says in the next 5 to 10 years, the climate could change so radically as to imperil the financial system. It's just insane. That is not true. It's not at all scientifically true. It's the sort of thing you can say over and over again and then justify your actions, but that's what they're doing. And the other thing, as far as climate policy, what they want to impose is a very narrow conception of climate policy. So if you're serious about the climate, you have to say the words, nuclear power doesn't generate carbon dioxide. Can you say those words for me? Just say nuclear power does not generate carbon dioxide. It's not that
nuclear power does not generate carbon dioxide.
Thank you. But you won't hear that out of the central bankers. if this is truly a threat to Western civilization, we should talk about carbon capture and storage. Yeah, that means you're still burning fossil fuels. But if it's possible to capture it, then you save the climate. We should talk about adaptation, which we'll talk about in a minute. If you're worried about the financial system cratering because of climate change, you should be willing to talk about, wait a minute, let's build some dikes. Let's spend some money on clearing the brush so the forest fires don't go. That protects the financial system. But no, all we're talking about here is defunding the evil fossil fuels and sending money to whatever the politicians in charge want to subsidize. If the politician in charge today, they're all enthused about electric cars and windmills. 20 years ago, they were all in charge of, remember, switchgrass, cellulosic switchgrass. That was George Bush's enthusiasm. Subsidize what the politicians in charge want at great cost and defund fossil fuels. That's not just illegal climate policy. That's bad climate policy. And that makes me a little bit grumpy too.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes into a broader theme that I've touched on in this podcast, which is this fiduciary crisis where, in my opinion, we have a crisis around society where people are not acting as fiduciaries for what they're supposed to. Instead, it's all this all-encompassing kind of orb of everything that is supposed to be, right. Like, it's the right thing to do this. Well, that doesn't matter. It's not your jurisdiction as the Federal Reserve. My question is...
This is a deep point. When President Biden said a whole of government approach, everyone said, oh, that's nice. That's nice. No! The founders are rolling over in their graves when someone says a whole of government approach. What about the separation of powers? What about constitutional limits? Limited government rule of law. That's how we're supposed to work. We don't just, vote in a 50% plus one president and he is then king for 4 years and the whole of government does whatever he wants. We should be shocked by that. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you just because you touched a raw nerve. Go ahead.
No, I'm glad. I mean, look, it's, this is, in my opinion, this is the narrative monopoly. And I think that empirically, there is a monopoly on narratives because there isn't pushback on something like this. I mean, this is supposed to be the job of a free and fair press to quote unquote, hold the government, hold power to account. And there's no one holding them to account. There's no one that says, hey, wait a second, you're exercising power that you don't have. You are no one that calls out the BS of if you're actually for climate change, why aren't you for nuclear? Anything like that. And so that's why I think it's really important to shed light on this stuff, because the people who claim to be the ones that are supposed to shed the light on it are not actually shedding any light on it. And they're actually part of the home team. And you know, that has all of these downstream effects on society. And I do worry, you know, how far can they go? And then what does that mean, you know, for tomorrow? What does that mean for tomorrow? What's the next power grab?
Incredibly important points. Too much of our, I guess it's because we don't teach civics anymore in the schools, but all of our political discussion is entirely on results, not process. You know, the kind of Supreme Court decision that I most celebrate are the ones where they say, look, this is a tremendously bad idea and it's a stupid policy, but it's constitutional, or vice versa. This is a wonderful idea that we need to have, but it's not constitutional. You know, go fix it. Nobody is, we jump to the result and not the process. And the process is what has kept us going for 250 years. The delicate machinery of government, the checks and balances, rather than just immediately jump to the result by whatever means, because a society that can jump to the result by whatever means can jump to the wrong result by whatever means. And it's kind of funny. It's the same people who keep bloviating about saving our democracy who are most interested in destroying our democracy, in destroying these constitutional limitations, the checks and balances, the limits on government agencies from just getting in whatever their mind is, the thing that needs to be done today. The other thing you mentioned, I think, is very important, is the media, which is not holding anyone to account. Well, they have become part of the partisan machinery. You know, the censorship of the internet and the willing censorship of media to become simply government propaganda machine like it is in China, and now the tech companies getting in bed with the government to pass the government. And as the most obvious example, first we're not allowed to talk about the Wuhan lab leak. That's misinformation. Whoops! All of a sudden, when the government says we're allowed to, now we talk about the Wuhan lab leak. What the real danger of that, I saw a while ago that Russia, if you want to find anti-vaxxers, go to Russia. I think it was like 17% of Russia has gotten the vaccine. Why? Because in Russia, everybody assumes that everything they're told is a lie. And why are we seeing such a outbreak of crazy conspiracy theories and anti-vax stuff? Well, more and more, the average American of any political party understands that what's printed in the media is the government's narrative. It's the left-wing narrative, and it's a lie, and that contrary, exactly what you wanted, contrary voices, the voices who look in the data and say, guys, how much do masks actually help? where did this virus come from? The contrary voices, which were the early part of this pandemic, was wonderful for the uncensored internet being way ahead of the government time and time again. But now that the internet and media are enforcing government censorship, the result is the opposite of the intent. What they want is, oh, everyone just believes the government line. The fact is, everyone assumes that they're always being lied to. And then that's when conspiracy theories and actual misinformation takes hold.
Yeah, I mean, Martin Gurry calls this the Mubarak switch, where the government thinks that they can just, you know, turn off the internet. And in our version, the Americanized version, it's that YouTube takes down videos talking about the lab leak theory. And I think the problem, you know, going back to the process piece, is you're not even allowed to ask the question. You're not even allowed to point out that there's other data that points to something. And the lab leak theory specifically, I mean, on day one, was something that was just common sense. It was, well, wait a second, this lab is one of, I think it's like one of, you know, 10 or 15 of these, like, you know, security level 4 labs in the entire world. It's the only one studying this exact type of coronavirus. It is a few hundred yards from this supposed wet market. And the Chinese Communist Party covered this up for months and months. Why would they do that if there was just, you know, if this was just so organic?
I don't know if it's true or not, but it's certainly a question that deserves discussion in a society that lives under the First Amendment, not now the tech companies working hand in glove with the government You know, the White House admitted that they're talking to Facebook every day about what should be labeled misinformation and what shouldn't be labeled misinformation.
You would think that folks who constantly cheer on the certain parts of the First Amendment would also like the other parts. And, you know, I actually wrote
They don't. Wait. the current strong movement is free speech is fine so long as it's my free speech, but your free speech needs to be censored, canceled, treated as violence.
You know, I wrote a piece not too long ago about the history of the First Amendment in terms of a free press. And the funny thing is that the freedom of the press, that specific clause in the First Amendment, was not actually meant for what we now deem as the media. In fact, you know, real reporting as we come to know it didn't start until the 1820s. And that was the first time that there was actually a reporter in the Capitol. And obviously, you know, the late second half Pax Americana version of objective journalism was clearly not a thing back then. And all of the case law in the New York State and the state of Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania Constitution, all of that revolved around citizens publishing on their own. And it had nothing to do with this quote unquote reporting. You know, there's actually this guy, Harry Croswell, was the editor of The Wasp, a Federalist newspaper, where, you know, he called George Washington a traitor and a robber. And that was like a huge case that, you know, Alexander Hamilton defended him and in the New York State. And, you know, this actually was like part of what went into codifying the state law around this. And it has nothing to do with, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, how you know it. So I you know, I got you on a couple tangents there. You got me on a tangent there.
This is an important tangent, and one most people think of our current conception of the free press as having been enshrined on day one in the First Amendment, and that's absolutely not true. You know, the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed immediately afterwards. World War I had horrendous censorship. People were thrown in jail simply for disagreeing with the war, and I would put it, there's a co-evolution of our very modern concept of objective fact-based reporting is a very modern concept. Newspapers, as you mentioned at the time, were scurrilous and they didn't even think it was they thought it was their job to make stuff up and sell papers. And they made all sorts of terrible stuff up. Most countries, newspapers are run by political parties. They're run by political parties. You know, they're there. They exist to offer this political party's view of things. So the concept of objective, fact-based, independent, apolitical reporting was a slow development. And I would hazard here, I'm going to guess, but it makes sense to me that our concept of freedom of the press co-evolved with that concept of the responsible, hold them to account, a political press. We are losing, we're certainly losing that concept of the press. So I think the way the millennials who go into journalism see themselves as advocates for social change, and their purpose is to advance their narrative. And we shouldn't be surprised, because universities don't ask for scholars and people who come to learn. On your university admissions now, it's how have you been an advocate for social change as a 17-year-old? So no surprise, they produce people who want to do that. And that's what the press does. And I think if I go with this co-evolution theory, our concept of a free press will probably die along with the responsibility of a free press to be an agent, an impartial agent. There was this sort of lovely period of the internet where it was impartial. I loved early Mark Zuckerberg. You know, you can put whatever you want here. Our job is simply to spread it around, to allow people access to whatever you want. That has gone now as well. They've become an agent of the narrative. So free speech always in danger.
Now, you know, one part of free speech, going back to the original concept of it, the Grumpy Economist blog. So I do think that, you know, blogging probably when you start, you started it in 2011, it looks like.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that was kind of on the tail end of the blogging heyday. I'm very bullish on a return or kind of a second iteration of this as, you know, people create tools to make it easier for everyone to publish and, you know, perhaps get more signal this time. Now, my question to you is a little bit open-ended. You know, this is one of the best, if not the best, economics blogs out there, in my opinion, and I think a lot of other people's opinions. What have you learned, or kind of what do you, I want to leave this open-ended on purpose. What have you learned, or kind of what have you gotten out of writing the Grumpy Economist blog?
So it's been a great, great thing for me. I really enjoyed it. As you can tell, you know, I'm good at spending a morning writing a first draft of something fun that would take the rest of the week to turn into an op-ed and chop me back to 900 words, which I find nearly impossible. It also allows me to range in ways that I couldn't otherwise range. So it's an ideal form of expression for what I often have, which is 1500 words of thought on some topic that I want to spend one morning on expressing. Now, as you're right, blogs are oh so 2010. I'm grateful to see things like Substack, Vox, Project Syndicate emerge, which I think they're more a blog. We always misuse things for things they weren't developed for. You know, the minute you see Twitter threads, you know, people are hacking around 280 words, and a blog was originally developed as, you know, oh, here's what my cat's doing today. And then we hacked around and turned it into what Substack is, sort of now a hosting mechanism for essays. The trouble I see with it is, permanence. I think I've actually had some great ideas in the blog that sort of come and go. And I mean, everyone thinks their own ideas are better than they should be. I wish my blog had more impact. You know, Paul Krugman has way more impact than I do. Now, maybe he's better, or maybe he's right. God forbid.
No, I don't think so.
So I'm trying to think about how does one have permanence and impact? You know, op-eds might last a week or two. So I'm currently thinking of, basically transforming, distilling it down to book form. The Substack, Vox, Project Syndicate, that kind of thing, since you do more editing, it's kind of halfway on the way to op-eds or magazine articles. And that I think gives it a little more polish and perhaps more reach. But so how to take the best parts of it and have more impact is something I'm thinking about. And yeah, you know, people tell me you should move to Substack. Blogs are so old fashioned. But
I think it gives you a little swagger.
Well, I don't know.
To be on the original Blogspot.
Well, there also is, you know, changing things is always, you know, I'll lose half of my followers if I change platforms. Although Blogger, Google, wake up and fix your darn Blogger. It's just so clunky. And I spend a lot of the morning wading through spam that even Google ought to be able to figure out that the exact same comment from an herbal medicine guy in Nigeria on 17 different blog posts. Can't your AI figure out that maybe that's not right? That's just an example. Google kind of abandons things. So maybe I'll have to because of that.
I wouldn't hold your breath on that one. let's make sure that we touch on the debt issue here. Because we did promise listeners that beginning of the episode. So you talked a lot about R less than G. So R being the interest rate on government debt, and G being the growth rate of the economy, if I have that right. And the theory goes, if R is less than G, if the interest rate on government debt is less than the growth rate of the economy, then we can just grow our way out of the debt and we can just keep spending and spending and spending. But you say this equation, like seniorage, is cute but irrelevant to fiscal policy. Why?
So it is a theoretical possibility. Suppose you borrow $1,000 to buy a new TV and you just leave it there. What happens? It grows at the rate of interest, right? And your debt, the debt keeps growing. But if your income is growing faster than that debt, then the ratio of debt to your ratio of debt to income will decline and your credit score will be just fine. And you can just leave it there. And the bank knows, you know, they can always, you can always pay it off eventually if you need to. And the same is true of the government. Now, this is a lovely theoretical possibility, but I don't want to get too deep into the economic theory of it. You can smell a rat in the economic theory. If it's true that the government can borrow and never have to raise taxes to pay it back, follow the logical implications of that. Why should you and me have to repay our debts? Why shouldn't the government just borrow money and pay off your student loans, pay off your mortgage? Actually, why should we work? If the government can borrow money, send it to us, and we don't have to ever pay taxes to pay that money back, government should just send us checks and we'll order from Amazon and live happy lives. You can tell that's not adding up. So I'll leave the theoretical question at that puzzle. But what I wrote about this is that it's a lovely theoretical possibility while it lasts. I mean, R may not be less than G forever. But it's not relevant to the U.S. fiscal situation. So here's how it works. Suppose the rate of interest is 1% and the growth rate is 2%. Then it is true that the government can run a 1% of GDP deficit forever, and then the debt to GDP ratio will be the same. Let me make that clear. So the debt to GDP ratio is about 100%. And so if the government runs a 1% of GDP deficit, then the debt to GDP ratio will be the same forever. But the problem is right now we have 5% of debt to GDP GDP deficits. And then every time there's a crisis, which seems to happen, we have a once in a century crisis every 10 years, we borrow another 20%. So just on a 1%, we have kind of a 1% pennies in the couch every year, but we have a 5% problem, 10% when 10 to 20% when a crisis comes along. Oh, and here comes Social Security and Medicare. So the R less than G possibility just isn't quantitatively up to the fiscal challenges of the U.S. And that's the basic issue. So it's a lovely possibility. Another way of putting the same observation. So lots of people, Olivier Blanchard wrote what will be a very famous American Economic Association presidential speech, where he said, look, the U.S. can borrow a ton of money, you know, fund the Green New Deal, trillions of dollars, and then R is less than G, let the debt to GDP ratio slowly decline. The debt grows at R, the economy grows at G, so debt relative to the economy declines. The problem with that is you have to run after the big borrow, you have to run balanced budgets for 50 years. You know, so the debt to GDP ratio only declines if you are running balanced budgets after the big borrow. Well, balanced budgets for 50 years, you want to set off a party in the Hoover lunchroom? Nothing like a promise that the United States is going to run balanced budgets for the next 50 years. That just ain't happening. That's not our situation. Our situation is not a slowly decline, balanced budgets with R less than G, so that any amount we borrow slowly melts away that we can borrow once. Our situation is exploding debt to GDP. And the entitlements are coming. So while it's a fun theoretical possibility, it's just not relevant to the fiscal problem at hand.
Now, 100% to GDP, highest we've seen since World War II. We are not in a World War III, so that's a little alarming.
Well, we haven't just finished World War III. Remember, the situation in 1945 was, yeah, we ran up a lot of debt to beat fascism, good thing. And then the spending was over. Our spending is only just getting going, but please go ahead.
Yeah, no, to your point, I mean, so Brian Riedel, he gave me these stats. He said, under the rosiest scenario, over the next 30 years, we will add $100 trillion to the debt because of Medicare and Social Security primarily,
yep,
and the boomers coming of age. And then the other thing that's so $100 trillion baseline, 30 years. The other thing is that when you say R less than G, the interest rates were borrowing short term, right? So I believe the average maturity is what, like 52 months on, yep, on the government debt. And so we're not even locking in these longer term rates or these low rates long term. And so this is something that you've talked about where, you know, Greece was not in a crisis until it was. And that's kind of like how it happens where, you know, people want to know like what date, you know, send me a calendar invite for like the day that, you know, everything's going to explode, but that's just not how it works. So could you walk through kind of like, you know, I know you're not in the prediction making business per se, but you know, how this theoretically could unfold.
Yeah. And how it will, just the question is when, and we don't know when. I think that's right. And I think it's where, you know, I want to offer sort of my worry about the debt is a little out of the box. It is true right now, interest rates are very low. And so the U.S. can borrow money, especially if it borrows short term, the way it is. And I sort of liken the situation to, you know, a couple buying a house in about 2006 in the great, before the great mortgage, in the great mortgage explosion. And they say, oh, look, honey, the bank is offering this adjustable rate mortgage and it's, you know, only a couple percent. And, you know, my boss has promised me a raise next year. House prices only go up. What a great deal. And then, of course, when the interest rate readjusts, we discover we have a problem here. And that's kind of the problem. And I think it's important that the rhetoric surrounding debt, the rhetoric tends to be, oh, our grandchildren will have to pay higher taxes. And if you notice, that rhetoric hasn't been particularly salient for the last 40 years. And you got to hand it to them. You know, they were right. We have the debt crisis hasn't come. So I don't, the things people worry about with debt, that interest rates will rise, crowding out investment. Well, you know, interest rates are rock bottom. You don't see that happening. And if that were the danger, you would have plenty of time. Oh, interest rates go up to 2, 3, 4%. Gee, I guess we got to do something. It's, you know, problems that come slowly that you have time to do something about aren't that worrisome. So the problem I worry about is exactly that large debt sets you up for a debt crisis doom loop. Not so much that, oh, we'll have to gently raise taxes on our grandchildren. We're going to be way better off than we are anyway. but that a Greek-like or Argentina-like situation will happen in the U.S. And it can. And it has, by the way. 1972 was pretty darn close to a debt crisis. It was mostly in the international markets, but you know, the UK has had debt crisis. Advanced countries can have debt crises. And the scenario is you borrow a ton of money and you kind of blow it, which is where we're going. Blow it. Let me not be, our government is borrowing money and mostly sending checks to voters. And, you know, voters are needy. They like getting checks. So I don't want to say blow it, but, you know, that's mostly what we're doing is borrowing money and sending it to people to finance consumption. And then the day comes when financial markets say, how are you guys going to pay this stuff back? And I want to emphasize that's not, the danger is not sort of the debt to GDP ratio. It's the debt to GDP ratio relative to faith that sooner or later this will be paid back. That's why there's no magic danger debt to GDP ratio. It's all about faith that, like we talked about, faith that the Fed will come do what it takes when it's time, faith that should things get tough, America will do what it needs to do after having tried everything else, which is to pay back its debt. So when that faith starts to get questioned, what happens is R is no longer less than G. Typically it happens that G, it's a crisis, so the G is going way down. And bond markets say, you know, we're not lending to you at 1.5% anymore. We want 5% because there's trouble brewing. Well, 5% interest rates means the deficit just exploded by $1 trillion a year. And the markets say, whoa, you want $1 trillion more? I think that'll be 6% interest rates. And you can see where this spirals out of control. So that's, and the magnitude of that catastrophe is something I don't think we think hard enough about. We just say the U.S. Will always print money and never default on its debt. Really? Is Congress really going to say we're going to inflate away senior savings in order to make sure that we pay back money to the Chinese central bank? Don't count on that for sure.
Well, back to
political chaos is plenty there. So let me just finish the the thought. This doom loop can happen. You can go a long time. You know, look at Japan. They've been sitting there for a long time. Like earthquakes in California, you can go a long time with it quiet before it happens. It comes unpredictably. And the key ingredient is short-term debt. Given that they're not going to solve the spending and taxing problem anytime soon, the least they could do is buy the 30-year fixed rate mortgage so that if interest rates go up, we don't lose the house. It would only cost a teeny bit more than this rolling over short-term debt business. And then we buy insurance that the U.S. will never have a debt crisis for a generation. Come on, guys. If money is free, the least you could do is borrow that money free at very long-term interest rates, not at short-term.
Why don't they issue everything in 30-year treasuries?
And not just 30 years. Let's keep going. Perpetuities. Right. Good enough for Queen Victoria. Good enough for us. So why don't people do obvious smart things is a hard thing for me to fathom. I know the arguments on the other side. I got into a very good debate with Larry Summers on this, which is in a Treasury volume where he had some simulations and said, well, you know, the chances of interest rates going up are so low that, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, you know, the chances of a house fire are so low, honey, that the insurance premium just isn't worth it. So I think that's one valid answer. You look at it and say, well, you know, it's costing us 1.6% to borrow long-term, and we can get it short-term at 0.5%. So we save 1% by exposing ourselves to the risk of this debt crisis. And oh, the chances of a debt crisis are so low, don't worry about it. Well, it's like the argument, don't buy the insurance because the premium's too expensive. That's one argument I've heard. But you know, the American political system, as we have just noticed, is not particularly good about thinking about rare crisis, unusual events, despite a history that goes back at, you know, millennia, despite many pandemic plans sitting on the shelf. What part of the American government was thinking about, gee, a pandemic could come and what's going to happen to the economy then? In particular, all the stress testers at the Fed who now think they're going to take on climate change. Not one of them thought to ask a bank, hey, what happens to you if a pandemic comes? So the general, you know, nobody wants to think of the out-of-the-box events, I think, is part of the problem.
We've covered a lot of ground here today. I know I got to get you out of here soon. Let me end with this. So, you know, you've written extensively about a wide variety of topics. You know, you've written a book on asset pricing. You've written about government debt, obviously, healthcare. More recently, talking about climate. So do you have a specialty, or are you just naturally curious and bouncing around? You know, what is the what's kind of your go-to subfield of economics, if there is one?
I have a specialty in the sense of I have an area where my academic expertise and knowledge of the academic literature is strongest, and those specialties are asset pricing, how stocks and bonds interact with the macroeconomy, and lately monetary policy, inflation, debt. I'm working on a book, Fiscal Theory of the Price Level. But what I love about economics is my ability to range widely. You know, I have written even academic articles on health insurance and how to solve that problem. And I can range, I can be an informed opinion person. I can, you know, start getting into climate economics. And, you know, my part of why I left physics is I recognized that one would have to specialize early. And this is sort of like physics in 1810, when you can take on all sorts of things in a somewhat knowledgeable, scientific, not just here's my opinions, here's your opinions way. So that's been wonderful part of this adventure.
Well, I'm equally curious about a variety of topics, which is why I love this podcast, because I get to choose who I get to have on. So thanks for coming on. Any closing thoughts for the audience?
Well, we could keep going for an hour.
We could absolutely keep going.
I'll just say, in response to your last question, there is a uniting theme, and I do have a philosophy, which I'll just say is freedom. Freedom is good, and freedom brings prosperity. There's that little canary in the coal mine. Nobody in our political system is thinking about how to foster long-run growth. And the answer is freedom, freedom and competition. And that's, if there is a uniting theme to what I call incentive economics, that's it. And that leads to the out-of-the-box answers, which you will find on Grumpy Economist and many other places.
I will second that notion that freedom rocks. Freedom rocks. Okay, so everyone can find you at The Grumpy Economist. I will put that in the show notes. And also, for folks who don't listen, Goodfellows podcast with you, H.R. McMaster and Neil Ferguson, you know, The Economist, the former general and historian, is quite the combo. So encourage everyone to subscribe to that. And we definitely could have kept going, but I only have you for an hour and we're already over that. So thanks for coming on, John.
Okay. It's been a pleasure. We'll be right back.